iPad, play. Oh shit, unhijack. Oop. Release. Quiet. To listen to. So here we go. Oh, actually, it's not yet. I'm a little nervous because I'm running later than I usually do. I'm usually a little bit more on time. Life is short. Break the rules. Forgive quickly. Kiss slowly. Love truly. Laugh uncontrollably. And never regret anything that made you smile. Someone wise and unknown said that. So, my name is Swan, and I'm sending you kisses slowly from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this is the part you need to listen to. The men upon the news, they try to tell us all that we will lose, but it's so easy in this blue. Okay, I'm being silly. That's my jam song right now. I like when I need to get pumped for anything, I'm like this song and I'm like, all right, I can do life. Life is doable. I'm so excited about today. I have two amazing artists, Greg Kerkorian. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nailed it.
And Madeline Lloyd Davis. Wonderful. I'm really stoked. I did some Google stalking and I found lots of images, but not a lot of like background info. So Greg is an artist and poet from Queens, New York, working under the name Gregorius Streak. And he is doing a lot of experimental collaborations right now. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Madeline, I'm not sure if you work for Comixology, but you came up under their Twitter feed. So. Oh,
yeah, I'm a former Comixology employee, but not currently.
Yeah, and you're breaking into the field of...
I would say mostly writing. Okay. And I've written a little bit in the past. I've had a couple of articles published on The Toast and hoping to spend more time writing and doing other artistic pursuits.
That's so exciting. Me too. But I'm not sure what I'm writing yet. So, well, actually, I have seeds, but I'm not ready to talk about them. And then we're also promoting Plumbunt, which is, I'm quoting from your website, the projects under this umbrella are as varied as a range of ties with an elegant minimalist butt pattern on them. A sex-filled psychedelic flip comic that is half fantasy, half sci-fi, a pornographic monster calendar, and so much more to come.
Right.
Sounds pretty exciting.
So it's like kind of a... The whole project is at an interesting place, and it was always at an interesting place because it's like unlike so many projects that I've tried, or I guess a view that you might have on art, like that the artist gets struck with this force of like complete inspiration or a vision, and then like from this like inherited vision, like incomplete vision, they produce that into the world and send it forth. I really think there's like. Maybe that does happen, but oftentimes, like, regardless of how close that vision was to your final product, the process of making it is, like, extremely transformative. And this is, like, the greatest version of that.
Yeah.
It started because my friend and I last year, I bought a table in comics. We work in comics, basically, at least at this point. And I bought a table at the first gay convention in New York, partly sure. because it was a way of supporting the creation of the first gay convention in New York. It was like a prize for like a certain amount of money. But that amount of money is like a lot to give to a Kickstarter for mm-hmm. me anyway. But like almost not. It's like a super. It was like a discount rate for a table as well, because tables at comic conventions can be like up to $100 more than I paid, or more, even more so.
Sure.
So like for many reasons, I was like, see, like I'll finally table at a convention. Even but I had like just started moving into comics from writing more poetry and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have that much content, and I got into basically a silly conversation with a friend at a bar about drawing a pornographic calendar with monsters having sex in it called Exquisite Corpse. It was basically just a pun, but that was enough. And I was really excited about the idea of that. Well, we can talk about that project in specific, but like basically as that joke turned into a real project, it took on like the project took on some like political kind of subversive, like within overt pornographic context, having a more politically subversive view, or trying to represent different kinds of bodies and things like that. So like the project evolved into something I felt as a vision was politically was really interesting.
PC and pornography.
Not PC though. It's the opposite.
Just
it's like
diversity.
We can talk about like what that is, but diversity is one aspect, but not PC. Like the idea of why it should be so overtly sexual is like, well, first of all, not to shit on PC-ness. PC-ness is great, and censoring people's like rude and awful language is not, I'm not saying that, but the goal of this is actually to be like more like ecstatic, as opposed to like guarding kind of and figuring out where everybody stands, to be more like a sudden explosion of understanding, which is like kind of a sexual explosion is like the implication there.
Yeah, I also think that in the queer community, something that gets criticized a lot is this feeling that in order to try and get more rights, we are kind of assimilating into the straight community and trying to, you know, the argument that a lot of people are making is we're just like you, you should treat us the same way.
Mm.
And part of that is a kind of desexualization that can happen in queer activism. And I think that this can kind of be framed as an attempt to say, actually, we want to celebrate this kind of weird sexual pornographic thing that we can do because we like it, and we don't need to be looked at in the same way as everyone else.
Yeah.
And maybe even, like, let's get, like, the reason that I wanted to do Monster, like, Monster King, I mean, it literally did come from a joke. Like, I like the idea of how aggressive the notion of necrophilia is in that joke. So, and that aggression, it's like a kink that's, like, even further, even more inappropriate. Like, monster sex, death, like, zombie sex, something like that seemed like something, like,
they're
not only do
animated,
I don't want to do, like, a
like
return
choice.
I don't want to do like a return to the fetishism of like the 1950s as a way of saying like that's what gay should be necessarily, but more of like it's really at this point a question. Like it's really we're investigating a question as opposed to like putting out a solid vision into the world, which is like, so what does a kind of new, what shouldn't be these new images of, what is a forefront of kind of like gay sexuality? What are new visions within gay sexuality that are politicized? And that's why different bodies are included, because they should be included as a natural, that's not like like, we should include different types of bodies because, like, that's a nice thing to do. It's like, why? It's like clearly a vision of sexuality at this point. It's like, it should include different bodies. That wasn't, like, there was no, like, contrivance there. It's just part and parcel of any vision of sexuality at this point.
Question that I have coming from my background experience. Part of a main tenet of burlesque is celebrating bodies of all shapes and sizes. How much of that scene do you think interacts with comics at all, if at all?
I think there's a lot of overlap, especially in this sort of philosophical conversations that go on about both areas.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something fringe about burlesque and about comics, maybe mm-hmm. in a different way, but in a way that really ties them together.
Yeah, it's like sex industry. There's this shock and awe factor, but it's also, underneath all that, it's also about telling a story.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what the value of including diversity is, you know, all shapes, bodies, personalities, is that it makes it human, which taps into the archetypes of who we all are. We all have all these multiple facets, not only, like, of our personality, but also of our sexual preference,
mm-hmm.
potentially.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think that if you look at really classic queer theory, like Foucault, talking about what does queer actually mean? One of the, I think, best distilled ways of explaining that is anything that is contrasting with what is considered highbrow or acceptable or, you know, good for society. And I think that you can look at comics and pornography and burlesque in this way of inherently queer because they're saying, no, we're not interested in aspiring to be like this amazing, you know, following the tradition of really important canonical works. It's saying, let's look at the things that people shit on and, you know, kind of elevate them and make them important.
I think because we're talking about language as well on this show, like there's a focus on or there's an interest in language. I've like felt really, I'm trying to think of where the starting point in this should be. Well, anyway, there was like kind of a gay language basically in Britain, a slang called Polari. But it was also like a circus language and a blah, blah, and anybody who was being rejected by society language kind of, but definitely a gay language. And so, actually there's a, like a little short film right now that I can like link to or something where they have a conversation and it's completely incomprehensible. It's kind of incomprehensible.
I'll put it in the notes.
But it's like, it's a slang language. And the reason I bring that up is like, so these people, in line with what you were just saying, it's like, you know, you get forced into like kind of being seen as like, perhaps like you get forced into being an outsider, but also to being like trashy or something, like this kind of this trash of society.
Yeah, like,
but out of that develops a language, and then that language has a kind of linguistic beauty that forms.
Yeah.
And that, so I think in all, like, I'm interested in that kind of transmutation, like, and that is at the heart of what impassions me about, like, why comics or why any kind of, like, when on that site I talked about a tie, right, that I wanted to do that as a butt pattern on it. And there's, like, a deliberate kind of corny, cheesy campness to that image, but done in an elegant style, hopefully, because the way in which that kind of, there's something kind of aggressive about that, about refusing to stand out, like, either in sophistication or in kind of camp jokey trashiness.
Yeah.
And I love that. And that's, so that, like, even though that's a tie instead of, like, a comic, which is another form that like traditionally was a trash content in America, in all ways, I feel like that transmutation is very queer and exciting, and something that I think that I personally like strive to say this: if queerness becomes normalized or whatever, like if gayness is accepted, why is there an argument that, you know, this kind of cultural mode that was produced in like homosexual spheres or in gay queer spheres, whatever, depending on what you're talking about, why should that survive? And I think it's because that type of transmutation is super beautiful and powerful.
We just kind of dove right in to
really.
No, I'm excited about it. I do want to talk about the journey that you guys have been on that has gotten you here. In talking with you about being on the show, we mentioned the trajectory that you guys are just both starting your careers and that they're just starting to blossom. And you're just starting to see these, excuse me, fruits. And so maybe talk about like what got you here, and then we can visit, you know, where you're going next.
I have a really amazing story about what I think sealed our friendship for all of eternity, which is that at the time we were coworkers and knew each other sort of tangentially. And
we didn't work directly together, basically. Like, we were coworkers in the water cooler sense, not in the, like, hey, send me the notes on this, whatever sense.
Okay.
And we started talking at one point and realized we were both really into Greek mythology. And it turned out that...
Love, like, obsessively
really,
love.
Really, really a lot. And it turned out that there's this series of lectures from the teaching company, which, you know, they have professors come in and give a series of lectures and they record it and you can listen to it.
Okay.
And it turned out that I had disc one and Greg had disc two.
Oh,
I forgot about that. It's like a best friends forever charm that makes like a heart that works.
We match.
Yeah. Yeah. So that
you
was,
complete me.
I think that was probably a cosmic
That's
sign
real.
From the universe that we were meant to make pornographic comics together.
I agree.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Such a great thing to bring up because this woman that gave this lecture, Elizabeth Vandiver, is so like, if anybody listened to her without being a tremendous geek like us, is probably like, you know, she kind of sounds like a professor, like maybe like a little stodgy or something, I guess, potentially. Like, you might think like, you know, this is just an educated academic and, like, I'm not that interested, you know, except for in the knowledge that she's giving you. But, like, both of us geeked out about this woman, partly because she loved mythology so much, but she also has these, like, little moments that she reveals in her, like, speeches about how she's, like, slagging on different, like, professors' viewpoints, but she's, like, really keeping it subtle. So, you know, there's, like, this little internal life.
Ooh.
And I feel like that's also, like, when you talk about, like, heroes or inspirations, the fact, like, I, like, love that woman. Like, I wish I could meet her.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I totally feel like she would be, like, somebody just might be, like, oh, I'm interested in learning about mythology. No, like, Elizabeth Vanderver, that's her, like, her name is, right?
Vanderver.
Wherever you are.
Like, Elizabeth, give us a call.
Yeah, like, give us a call.
Let's
we love you calling.
Buddies.
She's so awesome, though. If anybody ever wants to learn about Greek mythology, please seek this out.
Because nice
it's so
place to start.
So comprehensive and incredible. So incredible. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. That was just geeking out, really, though.
So as
we're like the two-person, at least the two-person secret, like, Elizabeth Vanderver.
Yeah.
Like, society or something, like fan club.
So, Madeline, you're more working with words and writing. Is that always, like, as a child you were writing things, or is that something that's been developed?
Well, I have always thought of myself as a writer, as though it were sort of this identity. And I had a big revelation in college, which was that you can't do that if you're not actually writing. And I had been spending a really long time thinking, oh, my God, you know, this is going to be so good when I write about it someday. And I'm like this outsider creative person. But I was not really producing anything. And that was a hard thing to sort of recover from. I think I hope that that's something other people can relate to, although maybe not. And I still find the process of writing incredibly painful and difficult. Mm. And the more I care about what I'm writing, the harder it is.
Yes.
And I, like, will sit there for 3 hours and not write anything, and it gets harder and harder.
I'm so grateful for your experience because I think it is romanticized. I think people talk about writing, and it's like, it's just that, it's this ethereal dream of, like, someday, when I have time or whatever, then I'll write. My mantra for the year, I say every morning and night, is I am a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I am a writer who writes.
Yeah.
Because I'm coming from a similar place where every time I had a paper or research anything for school, it was like, bam, A plus, I've got this.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it's like, okay, free structure, what do I want to write? I'm like,
Yeah, it's painful. It's really hard.
But I think that's, I mean, I don't know. I think that there's value in stepping into that.
I think so. I actually talked about it a lot in therapy and really got to the point. And I think this has helped me a lot as a writer, is to realize that one of the problems I had was expecting myself to instantly produce a reflection of these, you know, amazing, precious thoughts in my brain that were so beautiful and perfect. And the second I write a word that's imperfect,
that's
I was
hard.
Like, nope, that's it. I'm done. I'm not writing this, you know. And getting to a point where, and actually, Greg, you gave me such a good idea, which was that I was saying, oh, you know, maybe I'll write a romance novel, but I just have such a hard time starting it, and it's always so stupid. And Greg said to me, well, make it your challenge to write a terrible romance novel.
Yes.
Like, sit down and write the worst romance novel that anyone has ever written.
Someone on episode one is a songwriter, and I was like, where do you start? You know, if someone's like, I want to be a songwriter, what would you tell them? And she was like, well, the first thing I do is give myself permission to write the worst song in the world. And I think that liberates, because it can be the worst and you're just going to do it. And maybe it will be something that's usable, and maybe it's just like the shit that comes out before you finally get clean water.
Mm-hmm.
A small plug, I will be starting river writing, which is this interesting practice, and it's complementary to any other type of word activity. It's kind of seated in poetry, train of thought, and working with the community and relationships within writing. So you'll have a group of people, and you'll be encouraged to read out loud. And I think of it as the writing equivalent of painting, because you're working with layers. So it's seated in a poem. You hear a poem, you find the line that speaks to you, you use that as a starting place for a timed write. You write, everyone's encouraged but not required to read. it's interesting to be inspired by others and what they wrote and where they took it. And then also as you're writing, you feel different energy than when you're reading out loud what you wrote. And so you look at the pools of energy and you can actually start to layer and go deeper and, you know, explore things that have just arisen. And it's a way of practicing flow. So when you do sit down, you can give yourself permission to write 20 pages of crap. And then your first line appears, you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I had to go through all that to get here. Anyway, so I will be starting a class soon. If you're interested, hit me up somehow on social media. Self-promotion. Greg, how about you? Have you always been making things, drawing things, exploring stories?
So,
and
it's an answer that doesn't fit with like a narrative of like all these things led to here kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So it doesn't in that like what we're talking about right now is comics anyway.
Yeah.
So like I've always drawn, like always since mm-hmm. I was a baby, and like drawn very as an internal, almost therapeutic process. Like I drew it when I was thinking and stuff like that. It wasn't like, oh, let me go learn how to be a better artist kind of drive, or like, oh, I've been put in art classes, so now I like it, so let me do it. It was like, oh, it's always been like an internal, almost like similar to the way that your thinking works. I just like sit and let my hand move kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, like I kind of like later in life was like, oh, I can draw kind of, so let me draw comics, you know? And mm-hmm. writing wise, I didn't think I was interested in like creative writing or whatever. I thought that was something that I kind of figured out like in college maybe, or I had a short story class that I wrote a short story from in high school that was well received. But you know, I when I was in my creative writing classes, I remember distinctly thinking like, oh, I've kind of found myself in this and found that I enjoy this, but this isn't like an inevitable narrative. And then years later found like a short story I wrote like as a baby, like at like four or something, you know? So then you're like, ah, look, it was always there. But I don't think that's what, at this point, at this juncture where I am, I really don't think that that's what's leading to where I'm going as an artist and what the drive is. What's leading me where I'm going as an artist is like inquisitiveness. Like I'm not running out of, especially with Plump Bun, it's hard to talk about because it's so mutable right now. Like Madeline and I have this like connection, like a deep connection intellectually, and I really was interested in my projects going forward, at the very least when it comes to diversity, including like a queer woman's perspective, because yeah. I'm like, for many reasons, it's just obvious.
Yeah.
But anyway, but you know, we really just started this partnership like just now, as in like a more formal sense, and we're kind of like, instead of starting the process with like, let's work on this, we're kind of like throwing ourselves into something that is gonna transform before our eyes and stuff like that. And I think that in that way my life has led up to this point, because I've worked hard to, you were talking about writing bravery, right?
Yeah.
I feel like those kinds of internal pressures and questions have haunted me in a productive sense, like in that I've spent my whole 20s, instead of like achieving external goals, I've spent them achieving goals like, you know, how do I move through this world in a way that that's genuinely not destructive to other people. You know, that doesn't run over other people's voices, that doesn't, you know what I mean? Just because I want to express, how do I know that my expression isn't erasing somebody else's voice? Like, that's like a real, that's like not a writing concern necessarily, but it's like a philosophical concern.
Human relationships concern.
But it's also an important concern about, I mean, especially now we're talking about, because social justice is like very, very much present in the culture. And I think that's a real concern that like any writer that, or a creative person needs to undertake.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, despite being a gay man, I'm also a white cis male, you know, and that means the voice I put out there is in a way taking the place. It's not really taking the place depending on what the vehicle is, but in a way it's like might be, because of like privilege, stepping into the place of somebody else's story, because they basically, whoever's selecting them is probably also a white cis male or something horrible like that. So there's real concerns, like political concerns around just getting your voice out there that you can't really think about when you're coming up with your creative design.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think they can only get you, they only make you stop writing if you're thinking about it while you're writing.
Yeah.
That flow.
When it comes to, but it does matter about what you actually put out there. It matters. And so part of what Plump Bun is about partnerships, really, genuinely. Like, I don't want to do a single work. like, we have us because I need somebody. Well, it started with me and another friend, but he's really busy with other stuff as well. And Madeline is like a brilliant person. I'm really interested in her perspective, and she really sees the vision. So now we're together. We're kind of like going to be the people in the back end pumping force into this, like making this, pumping in just the willpower, the energy, the time, and probably the money as well to get this to be like a thing that exists in the world. But we very much, at least even from the start, and this is why it's not clear exactly where we'll be in 6 months when we go to FlameCon. Like, we're starting from a perspective of, like, if this is about a certain identity, like, hopefully we can be partnering with people to bring, like, perspectives we'd like to see in this world also, like, represented, or, like, kind of, like, visions that aren't, like, honed down into the single artist's genius, but rather are, like, a kind of community, like, some kind of fostering of community.
Yeah, I really
like
that.
So I think all of that has come through. That's that I have led to. Like, I've spent my time learning how to listen to people, learning... making mistakes, like saying...
offending people,
saying something
or doing...
Not even offending, like genuinely being awful because of inherited views and like being called out on it and actually sitting there.
And having to sit there with it.
Yeah, and thankfully, thank God, have somehow finding the strength to be like, okay, I'm not going to just like walk away into my cloister where... Because I'm being a shit. Like, I'm really nothing. Like, I'm an... Yeah. It's like actually me that's being emotionally violent to somebody else. Not like some hypothetical, like... hanging over a social force. It's like, me, I've just done this harm.
Yeah.
I have to say with that, those kinds of things have really led me.
Well, and to evaluate the belief structure that led to that, and then to reorganize, you know, the way you interact and see the world.
Right. So now I think I'll have the ability to go and say to somebody, I want to work with you on this, and I really want to hear your voice, and I want to create beautiful things. And I know, even though Plump Bunt has, like, the points you made about what queerness are is really interesting, and that's definitely at the heart of what we're doing. But what that is kind of like, it's a process, not a specific creative vision. So as long as we continue to produce things that are doing that same kind of queering, that same kind of creating that same kind of beauty, like, all of them will fit under the umbrella, and that's what's so exciting about the concept. And to be the kind of person who can kind of create that and to go out and connect people...
Yeah.
And try to, you know, and pull people
and
into
build these
doing
communities.
That process
is
something, is also is a writerly skill, is a creative skill. And it's something that's something I think I've been working on my whole life.
I think I could say the same. For you that have just tuned in, you've been listening to Ink and Worm, where I have Greg and Madeline talking about their erotic comic book career blossoming. And we're broadcasting on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thanks for tuning in. And if you have comments, questions, check out social media and we can start building that conversation. I do need to read, or not read, but just kind of explain something really fast. If you are listening, it's due to community support that this radio station even exists. And we're asking for help to keep it going. If you can pledge $1 a month, that's $12 a year. It's the price of cocktail, but it actually really helps a lot. So, you know, whatever you're willing to contribute, if you're enjoying what you're hearing on my show or on any other show on Radio Free Brooklyn, go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge, and you can get more involved with the Radio Free Brooklyn community and the amazing things that are happening with the station, and also keep us commercial-free, which is really awesome. And yay, independent radio, because we can say what we want and we can talk about these things and not be censored, you know?
Sure.
So I had a talking point about a book you were carrying around on Friday, and you said you're obsessed with it. Do you remember what book that was?
On the Move?
Yeah.
On the Go, is it? What's wrong with me?
I don't know.
It's Oliver Sacks' autobiography.
Oh, okay. Right. I was trying to remember it earlier today, and I was like, gosh, I don't...
I have the worst, like, that kind of specific memory. People don't think I haven't been reading.
Yeah. Like,
I really am obsessed with this book. I really am recommending it to everyone, and I still was able to forget one of the three words in the title.
Which is, I like that, because sometimes my memory's just gone, and I'm like, is this
it's pretty
old
hot
age?
Thing. I try not to think about
the
it.
Drugs I did? What is
alcohol,
happening?
Yeah. Copious alcohol, every
oh,
day.
Oh, shucks. Yeah, I drank a lot with you a couple weeks ago. we had to destroy the evidence of a whiskey bottle that magically appeared because we
and
went
then
and
disappeared too fast.
It.
Too
it was
fast.
Pretty
anyway,
fast.
No, but come on.
Yeah, I'm curious about the digital aspect, because it seems like digital media has changed
comics.
And we were both a big part of that.
Yeah.
Hey,
so,
pat yourself on the back.
So what are your thoughts on that transition? Do you think
I'm extremely cynical.
Well, here's the thing. I heard someone talking about the expansiveness of being able to have, you know, all of a sudden you're not limited to a page in terms of where the story can go. You're limited to this infinite possibilities of moving the screen viewer to wherever the comic goes. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I'm overwhelmed by that because visually I'm just like, infinity. But
no, you're absolutely right, though. That actually is a way of that's a promise that I don't think has been – that's like maybe on the experimental edge has been fulfilled, but that's really – it's kind of weird. It's like as the technology delimits you, you still have kind of human constraints. So like we still want to read one – you don't have to read one page at a time, but like there's a way in which your brain is like, but what comes next or like whatever. And maybe that's like a feebleness of our imagination, but I don't – I mean like a lot of comics are still three panels, a news strip, just like – it was literally in a news strip, you know what I mean, 80 years ago or whatever.
I think that if anything, we might see really interesting digital innovation like a generation or two from now.
Mm-hmm. And with the kids growing up.
Yeah, exactly.
So creative.
I know. We have a lot, like, a lot of pressure on them to do some good stuff. What I think is really exciting about digital expansion of comic book media is more regarding comic book audiences,
because
if you're relying on print comic books, it's this really weird industry where you have to go to like a special store to buy a comic book, and the vast majority of people don't live near one or don't know where they can get one. And I think that this is especially something that can keep little girls away from the comic book world because no one is there giving them comic books and expecting them to be interested in them. And so it's really easy if you're a girl to grow up and not even know that you need to go to a special store to get a comic book. And
Or for me, comics were something that I looked forward to hunting down in the paper.
Yeah. Yeah, I was
knowing,
the same way.
Yeah. Who is it? Kate Beaton?
Yes, Kate Beaton.
Who kind of has been...
What a badass.
She's kind of pushed the boundaries. And she hit it at a time when a lot of people were recognizing, like, wait, where's the women? Because they should be here and they should be creating. And she was like, I'm here. And stepped up to that.
Online has been great for that, though. You're talking about audiences and just, like, creators. Like,
yeah.
I mean, this is not like a super obscure plug at all, but maybe if people don't know much about comics, this is like a kind of thing I think anybody could love and read, which is that this woman named Erica Mohn does a comic called Oh Joy Sex Toy, which is actually like, it's one of those people where you see what they're doing and you're like, I should just give up on my project because they're so successfully doing this.
Yeah.
So she just basically, she does sex positive toy reviews.
Oh, I actually have heard of this.
You know this?
Yeah.
But like she also just like talks about sex in different ways and it's like super body positive. I mean, it's and not in like a, now I'm going to include a different person because it's like cute. No, it's like it really is so hearteningly beautiful how she's used kind of sex positivity to be like just progressive and as hell, just like really progressive as hell. And she's such a brilliant cartoonist and everything. And the point is that's about sex toys, sex toy reviews. Like that is some shit that should have been like, I'm talking about older society, like that's some shit that should have been like left for the trolls that like go to masturbate at the store. You know what I mean? And online instead, because there's like this ability to, there's this ability for communities to find themselves. Instead, this is like a feminist, sex positive thing that has found an audience and is changing minds and like introducing people to interesting ideas. And so online has, that's something I'm the opposite of cynical about. I'm ultra hopeful by that, you know, no matter what, you can find community, and so you can produce works that have an audience in beautifully, like, particular ways. That might have been obscure.
Do you think...
Or were definitely obscure. Never mind.
That makes me think of, like, an anonymity. I'm not saying that right. But just the ability to be anonymous, but interact with those communities and have, like, this digital persona. Like, you know, I'm Blue Blaze, and I have these opinions, and here's some of my work. How much do you think that affects... Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, man, I think that can be really great and also just the worst thing because I think, and Greg and I have talked about this a little bit, that this sort of anonymity and the ability to seek out these incredibly niche communities where you can kind of protect yourself from hearing anything outside of that sphere can really allow...
It's an echo chamber.
Yeah, and I think that you see that a lot with, I want to say especially, like, extreme right wing, or, like, if you go on Reddit and you look at, like, the Red Pill subreddit where you see these men who have all gathered together to agree about how we live in, you know, a female-dominated society and they're really oppressed.
They're trying
and
to kill all men. It's, like, an implication. Like, secretly, once they get in power, they'll...
We're not doing that? Yeah. Just kidding.
Well, we certainly wouldn't talk about it on the radio.
We can talk about anything.
But so I think that you do see that kind of anonymous echo chamber where people can share the worst part of themselves. And instead of that being, you know, like, I think there's a vulnerability and you can share a bad part of yourself in a way that can help you. But also on the internet, it's really easy for people to say, no, that's fine.
You're
and
just
then you
reinforcing
kind of, yeah.
those belief structures that don't serve you or the world wider community well. Yeah, there's that opportunity for celebration. But also, I think there's two aspects to criticism. You're removing any criticism from your logic. Mm-hmm. And there's also the whiplash of anonymous criticism that's really echo chambers interacting with other echo chambers,
and
you
also
could say.
Like, it's like toxic in the same way that, like, somebody who's really playing devil's advocate, and, like, sometimes there's like this notion, like, oh, I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm talking about in, like, person-to-person conversations. Sometimes it's like, oh, let's tease out further ideas, and sometimes, like, all you're doing is introducing
negative,
like, toxicity to a conversation that doesn't even need that viewpoint. And so, like, obviously that's trolls in the online space. Like, that's not, like, challenging a feminist to, like, refine her concepts because you say, like, bitch, women
it's
should
just
die.
Attacking.
Excuse people. I'm sorry, people. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, women, you all need to, like, respect your man and kill yourself or something. It's not, like, a refining, like, a really insightful...
What are you bringing to the conversation? Because...
it's not, like, a well-thought-out point. You know what I mean? And that's really, unfortunately...
Yeah.
On every YouTube video where any woman is saying anything positive about her life.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying.
Like, or like Jezebel comments or like, right?
Jezebel, they had to shut down their comment section for a while because people were posting like graphic rape GIFs in the comments without like it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, and this is something that I would love to talk
like
to you about,
really
is like this shock factor, reactive nature of what you do, because you are, I mean, sex and money, people get really emotional about.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting to see what I react to. I'm like, oh, that's disturbing me. Why? But a lot of people, that's just like it's a shutdown. It's a that's not right. That's or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. How do you confront the graphic, you know, offensive nature? You know,
dude, I'm totally appalled actually by like as like a, this is like an artist. Maybe everybody can relate to it, but definitely I'm sure artists can relate to the, like, abject horror of putting something out into the world and having people fully misunderstand it.
Yeah.
And feeling like that's not at all what I'm doing. And I, around what you're asking me about is like, totally a point where I felt this way. Like, at FlameCon, I had this calendar out. And, like, a big influence, and this is not an obscure influence, is Tom of Finland. And part of the reason for that is because he developed gay aesthetics, basically, through pornography, invented, like, a whole different... Before Tom of Finland drawings, which is a gay eroticist from, like, the 1950s or whatever, the notion was that the gay person... I mean, this is a very simplistic take, but anyway, the notion was that a gay male was essentially, like, exclusively a like, the feminine partner, quote-unquote, and, like, you know, was kind of, like, your straight husband might go fuck the feminine partner or whatever. There's like there was no masculine images largely in the public of like gay figures. And then he basically introduced all of these kind of masculine iconographies.
The different like, type of.
That you like think of the Village People, like that kind of iconography about like these like workmen as like masculine gay ideals is like pretty clearly influenced by this particular artist. And I think that's incredible. But one of the points that of inspiration that actually is a stronger point of inspiration for me is that there's real rape sequences and there's like weird BDSM, like there's all kinds of power structures.
But people fantasize about
that. But they're all smiling.
Yeah.
In his particular works, there's a utopian nature to his works. It's like, if the cops pull over the robber, instead of this guy rotting in jail because of economic disenfranchisement, which is why he was probably stealing, in fact, they all just fuck and everybody has a great time. In the end, you know what I mean, and like it's like a bonobo world. It's like happily we all fuck into the sunset.
Experiencing emotion.
So the shock and awe, like that's present at the super, at least with this calendar, which is kind of like that's like the spark that started the brand, quote unquote. I don't really want to be so brandy about it, but that started the idea of this kind of series of collaborations. The shock factor belies, if you look at them, a series of images of people having fun, of different bodies touching each other, of kind of keyed into like a dark history, and the fact that it's saying like there's room for us to kind of both laugh. Like that's actually one of my productions in there. But like, you know, there, like it's okay for us to look at like a time period when we were really being like brutally murdered and think about that. Even when we're thinking about our sexuality, we don't have to pull. It's like arguing for the fact of like a holisticness, basically. Sexuality as like a holistic,
like accepting
aspect,
kinks like as a part of it,
kinks and like, all of this stuff, and history and sadness and tragedy and scary stuff all in one, and like really sitting with those things. So it's not shock is about, well, shock is whatever shock is, but like shock could be about rattling somebody and sending them running away from something, or shock can be about shattering somebody's expectations and inviting them in.
I like
the latter is the kind of thing that, like, the concept is that leads to kind of an ecstatic transformation once you walk through. Oh my god, can I say a really nerdy thing?
Yeah,
which is that in Dune.
Yes,
so in Dune, like one of the really famous quotes from Dune is that fear is the mind killer.
Yes,
and so like basically. You could go into that forever, but basically, at one point, they literally have to drive a helicopter through like a swirling, deadly sandstorm, and this is treated in the book as like a totally transformative moment for the like messiah-like main character, because literally, as he goes through this, he like has epiphanies about like that the center of the storm is like safe and like the kind of ways in which he can engage with people, and like by going through that, he reaches to another side and sees how he can transform the world. I'm not going to go into the whole plot of Dune. But that kind of concept that you're, like, staring at a horrific maelstrom and that through it lies clarity and transformation as opposed to running the opposite way.
Well, telling another story
is what I like. Also, I just like Dune.
Yeah. Telling another story that demonstrates that, and perhaps you know the reference. I was with someone last night who has a tattoo that's, I think it was Hebrew, but it was basically a quote from the story where oh gosh, I'm not going to remember the details, so forgive me. Basically, this army has they realize that they're overpowered, and the captain's, you know, consulting his advisors, and they're like, we need to flee. And he's like, that's not an option. Burn all the boats. Like, we don't have the option to retreat. And so now that we've burned the boats, let's figure out how to do this. Mm. There's only one way out of it. We're going to go forward. And so how do we do that? I think it's a different take, but a similar theme of just like crazy experience. How are you gonna engage with it?
Fear is that you'll be slaughtered.
Yeah, or that. Well, we better have.
I feel like
a really good fucking plan.
Around a lot of triggering things, like politically.
Oh yeah.
Contentious things like racism, for instance, right? When two people of different that fit on any
or
end
like
of,
an
like,
age thing. Age is pretty.
How so?
People reacting to pedophiles is what I'm thinking.
Oh, that's intense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not standing on that
issue. We're not going to go into that, but I'm just saying
that. I haven't gotten on the Nambler.
Not yet.
Maybe in the future that'll become. It seems like every gay artist suddenly decides that they have to defend pedophilia.
No.
And I, at this point in my life, I haven't taken that stance. So
let's not go into that.
I think we're going to sort of controversially take the stance.
Rewind.
We're not going to defend pedophilia.
Okay. All right. So
rewind. What were you saying?
Just saying, like, on contentious issues, like, let's say race, right? Two people have to come together, and like, there might be on any possible different, like, place in a kind of spectrum of combative positions on the topic of race, potentially. Like, let's say if they're not agreeing, you know, there's a sense, really, a sense on both ends, I imagine, that like this confrontation could like end you, even though it's like doesn't make sense. Like you're not going to physically kill each other, hopefully. But like, or they're actually that really is horror. Let's not even go into that. Like, let's say it's just a conversation. There's like an internal sense, like if I dare to speak about this, like I could be destroyed somehow, yeah. either publicly in the face of public yeah, opinion or something. And so yeah. you can walk away or like just refuse to talk in that situation. Like, let's just never mention race around each other because we have two, like we potentially, not even they're we have clashing, two different yeah. viewpoints, but we potentially have two different viewpoints.
Or just like we'll never agree.
And so what? You never are going to test whether or not your ideas are fucked up. Like yeah. you are never are going to actually get to the root of like,
yeah.
You know, you're never going to, like, actually sit with your friend. Let's say it's a friend, actually. Or just, you're never going to really talk to your friend about their lived experience, because that yeah. could happen. What if I, yeah. as a white person, have a black friend? If I never talk about race, which is obviously in some way we're going to not line up, because it's I don't there, have yeah. the experience that they do, and their experience, unfortunately, in this country is...
Theirs.
Yeah. yeah, it's awful. So, like... So I could just be like, oh, like, why do we have to talk about this and, like, avoid it? And we could be friends, quote, you know what I mean? Like, live and let live. But I don't fucking believe in that. I think, like, I want to be torn down because I'm inheriting horrors.
You want to step
I'm
into the storm
violence.
And then see
I'm
what you
violence
learn.
And inherited. And I want yeah. them to destroy that part of me, yeah. to be honest. That's how I feel about it.
Right now I'm thinking about a John Donne sonnet. Are either of you... fans of his.
I've heard of. Go ahead.
But he has.
Oh,
he
John
has,
Donne, yes.
John Donne, yeah. He has one of my favorite of his poems is a religious poem where he asks God to destroy him. Batter my heart, three person God.
So dope.
And he just says, like, destroy me and tear me into pieces. And it's the only way that I can, like,
anything
be a person.
Good's gonna happen.
Yeah. Including a line that I love, which is, I cannot be chaste except thou ravish me. With this, I don't know.
It's I just, love it, yeah.
So mm-hmm. fucking, it's, like, the kinkiest.
It's like, give it to me, God. I want to lie down on my back. Yeah. Come fuck me.
I love him so much. Yeah.
That's basically
yeah.
that. That's what his poem's about.
Well, yeah, he just wants to fuck God brings and be a destroyed
new,
by him.
Yeah, it brings a new dynamic to love God with all your heart,
yeah.
mind,
yeah.
body.
Yeah, send an email back home to mom.
Yeah. Like, straight up in the bedroom. Hey, God.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that, I mean, so I'm an atheist and have never been able to relate to the sort of God part of that poem, but I do think there's something really powerful about wanting this sort of shattering experience.
Destruction.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's becoming a diamond through pressure yeah. and heat, or, you know, digging through ashes of what was there and then finding what was really there.
And the left right now is largely, or I mean, there's so many voices in so many ways, but I feel like a part of, like, the drive to create this kind of art with a very leftist point of view and yeah. with, like, a progressive point of view is that there's, like, a really strong sense in progressive movements right now that it's about finding a way to, like, respect the lines around everybody, which is beautiful in its way, but, like, I'm really more inspired by, like, let's all be destroyed and recreated.
Mm.
Do you get what I'm saying? Instead yeah. of preserving ourselves. So yeah. I'm not ready to yell at those people to criticize their viewpoints. Yeah. Like, I don't think that, I don't strongly feel that way at all. I think there's incredible things happening, and there's so many people yeah. fighting for their voices right now and fighting to be heard and being heard, at least in internet spaces.
Well, let's brainstorm, you know, really fast. I love giving a takeaway for my listeners. Mm-hmm. And so kind of what I'm sitting here thinking with is, like, you know, there's a lot of programs and campaigns to, I'm thinking specifically of read diverse books and
right.
of expanding
the
you
No
know,
White Men 2016.
Yeah, yeah. Or just, like, push the genres that have come to be the norms and, you know, what could happen. And I'm thinking of women in comics. So that's, you know, being a woman, I'm, like, excited about that. And I'm just like, you know, there's potential here. How do we tap into that? So I'm wondering.
Women are trendy in comics right now.
Yeah, it's true. It's like this. Well, because it's been unexplored for so long.
And
so now there's so much new.
Women are actually buying their own stories. There's yeah. a commercial component. Like, stories yeah. with yeah. women in them are actually selling. And
because they're
like,
women,
oh,
they're not
God,
just
how
like
strange.
Yeah. Well, and they're women who are who have depth and are dynamic and
yeah.
not just an
fetish.
Arm candy yeah. or, you know, the hag. It's moving past, like.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, what could a takeaway be for general listenership? So I'm putting that
as
question
writers
out to you.
As writers or readers?
Either.
I feel like
as a writer.
Well, I have a
That's yes. Yeah,
something to say that perhaps answers your question. I would recommend Gia from Jezebel recently wrote an article about the phenomenon of people saying, I'm only going to read books by women in 2016.
Oh, gosh.
And first of all, I which is not to criticize it, but she wrote about how frustrating she finds it to have people really publicly patting themselves on the back for doing
an
that.
Effort.
And
well, it's just a swinging pendulum. That's just as extreme.
And the problem that she had was that by doing that, you can let yourself off the hook for a lot of other things. And that when you publicly say that you are an ally because you're only reading books by women, that is not an act of activism, that's a way to open yourself up and be this really powerful internal experience. But that doesn't make you an activist, and it doesn't make you a feminist necessarily.
No. Yeah.
And she writes it in a much cleverer way than
I'll
do.
I'll see if I can find it. I might ask you to send me a
link. I can definitely do that. Which is not to say that I don't think people should do it. I think that it could
just
be a great experience.
Expand maybe a challenge is expand an area that you haven't explored, but don't be exclusivary. Like, don't limit yourself.
So we're talking in your reading practices? Is that what we're talking about?
I think that's where we went with it.
Okay.
Or if you're exploring, we don't have a lot of time. So I think let's leave the challenge at that. Explore something that hitherto now you have not. Whether it's reading a book by someone who's a different gender, a different race, a different socioeconomic class. I don't know how many different ways you could answer the question.
How about just thinking about why you're reading something, like when you read it? Like if you pick up a book.
Why are you reading it?
And I'm not saying this is like I'm like a holier than thou. I really personally like feel challenged by this concept. But like.
Yeah. Well, we're all limited by our own.
I was just invited, for instance, to like a book club. I'm already in a book club, which is problematic. But anyway, I was invited to a book club that's going to be like a bunch of queers talk with like a focus on kind of not directly academic books, but books that can like basically are founded on theory, like that have like that are really engaged with a kind of queer theory, a kind of whatever, like any kind of radicalism,
philosophical
stuff like that.
More maybe.
Yeah, stuff like that. And the reason that I at this point, which is different than my normal reading, which has been totally eccentric, the reason that I was really like, you know what, I might actually try to find time, really find time in my schedule for that, is because I'm producing works that have that are missives to some extent on queer ideas. And I've read some queer theory before, like some, but basically I feel like if I'm going to produce in that genre,
you need to know what's there.
I should keep reading, keep reading, you know? So I feel like there's like a consciousness to that selection. And then like you can also read a, you know, like some beach book, like obviously you don't have to be so hella serious about everything you do. In fact, levity could be great in general in life, but I think that's a great thought to bring to what your influence, like what these are going to become your influences.
Sure,
like it's kind of like watching what you eat.
Nice.
Don't eat trash.
Well, in moderation. So we actually only have a few minutes left, believe it or not. I know. I like to end my shows with a rapid-fire series of questions. We might get to one question. We might get through a few, depending on time. And then we'll wrap up here. So my show is more about reading and writing, so that's what these are geared towards. But obviously, any input you have is going to be your own experience as well. So what book have you not gotten around to reading?
To reading at all?
Yeah.
Like, I'm on page 300 of Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow.
Rainbow.
Yeah.
And I really liked reading it, and I found it to be totally kind of like, it was difficult, but I liked the kind of jumps and stylistic invention that he was doing. But for some reason, I just had transitioned out of a point at which I wanted to read that kind of writer's big ideas anymore. Like, I loved a lot of writers similar, and then suddenly, like in the middle of the book, I stopped. I was like, I want to read different voices or something.
Yeah.
And I'm just, and it breaks my heart. Like, I really like look at it, and I'm like, I wanted to finish this book, but it's just not what I want to read right now.
Sure.
So I know that.
Anything coming to mind?
I've been reading Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton for like 4 months, and it seems to get longer and longer. And the Hamilton musical is like one of the most inspiring and just incredible works of genius, I think, that has been produced.
Yeah.
I don't know, ever, maybe. But I was like, yeah, I want to read all about Hamilton, and I really have been wanting to do it. And I just keep reading. I read one page, and my Kindle app tells me I have like 25 hours left reading the book.
Oh, no.
It's
You're
difficult.
Like, well, on. There but I'm gonna,
I'll
motivation.
Do it the next time I come on the show.
Is there a book you remember your parents reading to you?
Go for it.
Well, the biggest thing was that my mom would make up stories and tell them to us. She would, my sister and I shared a room, and she would lie on the floor in between our beds and tell us stories.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't immediately think of that, but my mom told over and over again in youth, my mother's Romanian. Both of my parents are from Romania, actually. But there's like a, just like a basic children's story about a deer, and then the wolf eats all her kids, and then she has to like fry him in a pot, basically, and has like a little song in the middle. And it's so, like, the harrowingness and darkness of that story being for children is so awesomely, well, not just Eastern European, but it feels Eastern European. And
yeah.
It's something that I always want to respond to how awesome that is, like, how dark and weird and awesome.
For children.
Yeah.
So, do you have any rituals or routines related to your reading and writing, or for you writing comics? Like, do you need a certain pen or cup of coffee?
Mm.
That type of thing.
I don't.
No? Free for all?
The only thing is that I tend to play Spider Solitaire on my computer, like, at 45-minute intervals through any long writing session.
Just to break it up.
An article just came out that said that was, like, the right thing to do.
Oh, yeah. I'm such
or
a
look at pictures of... Oh, my. Yeah. Psych. Or look at pictures of baby animals.
Oh.
Put you in a better mood is, like, scientific studies proof. Yeah. How about you?
It's like a problem that I've had, which is that I'm really super chaotic, and I feel like it's made me less, like I'd probably be producing much more consistently if I did, and I just keep struggling. Like every time I get a ritual,
it's gone.
Yeah, pick another ritual.
Way.
It's terrible.
Yeah,
it's a bad way to get a ritual.
Way.
Everybody get a ritual. Obsessive compulsive people produce a lot of work.
Social media,
or just
pick rituals
within
for
that
us.
Structure. It starts to build the neural pathways to be more productive, and within that,
yeah, that's real. Yes.
What authors are showcased on your bookshelf?
Oh, cleaning your space is so helpful. Every time you think
I
it's not going to matter,
it.
And it's so relevant.
Yeah.
Do have a clean desk. That's
I
real.
Because
I never do, and every time I do it again, I'm like, what's
like,
wrong with
bam.
Me? Sorry, go on.
Okay, so the next question is: what authors are showcased on your bookshelves?
Oh my god, I have a lot of weird authors. Let's just say porn people. There's like Harry Bush.
I want to come to your house.
Tom of Finland. Yeah, I have a bunch. Like, there's a collection called Massive that came out last year with like Japanese.
Massive is incredible.
It's so awesome with Japanese, like kind of bearish pornography. So those are cool. And then I have a lot of theory randomness. And
yeah,
like,
I've been rereading Hilary Shute, who has written a lot of feminist comic theory. She's wonderful.
Yeah.
Lots of comics.
Lots of comics.
So just
comics.
So many comics. Leah Wishnia has put out some like
such
incredible,
a badass.
I would recommend seeking her out. She probably takes up the most space on my shelf because I have like a lot of paper copies of her stuff scattered around like the entire perimeter of my room.
Let's see if we can get one more question. What is the best writing advice you've been given?
Go.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat what Greg said, sort of, or, you know, what he told me, which is to write something bad. Just sit down and write, because you aren't a writer unless you're writing.
It can be awful.
Yeah.
It can be bad. It can be the worst. And then it's out of you, and then you get to see what's behind it.
Oh, my God, I totally know. Exactly. Samuel Delaney, who's a fucking awesome person, you should look him up, even if I can't tell you. Can't speak about him now because we don't have time.
Yeah.
But he wrote a book, and I literally have put it down because I wanted to save it for when I was writing like a longer form thing, because that's what it's about. But it's on writing, and I recommend reading his book in general. But one of the points he makes in a really hard on you kind of a way is when you're a new person that's not bothering, and I'm bad at this. I'm really bad at this. This is why it's particularly affecting. Which is like, you think you're unless you've like bothered to study, you think you're inventing something, but all you do is invent already invented things. So it's hard. It's very, very unlikely that you're inventing.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely you're inventing unless you bother to study your form.
I'm
going to
cut
really
you
great.
Off. I'm so sorry. We'll have you guys back and we'll talk about
how things have gone.
Yeah, where have you gone?
Yeah.
Empty Orchestra is next, exploring dynamic relationship between song and singer in the context of karaoke. And I'll leave you with a word, take it or leave it, clandestine.